Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. After skyrocketing in 2017, the price of Bitcoin is at a six-week low this morning after government officials in China and South Korea hinted at crackdowns on cryptocurrency exchanges. But before Bitcoin can be traded on an exchange, it has to be mined. For Bitcoin, expensive high-powered computer processors do that work around the world, but smaller operations with alternative currencies are also possible. And college students are getting into the mix, mining cryptocurrency as a fun, cheap way to learn about the technology and earn a profit from the comfort of their dorm room. Tech reporter for Quartz, Karen Howe, recently wrote about dorm room cryptocurrency mining. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. Thank you for having me.
So mining is a lingo word that we're using. What, it's not literally mining. It's what? What are they doing?
That's a great question. So mining refers in this instance, in the broad landscape of what that means, because Bitcoin is a type of currency that doesn't require a centralized bank to verify. When I send you money, the miners are actually the ones that are verifying the transaction to make sure that I have the money to send to you. What they're actually physically doing is they are typically using, the students that I spoke to are typically using personal computers like desktop computers or even laptops, and they're boosting them with graphics cards, which are traditionally used for video editing or video gaming, and in this case are serving to increase their computational power. And they're taking these souped-up computers, downloading software, and then running the software, and that's actually what mining refers to.
And it's not without its costs, but what's sort of interesting here is that a lot of them are doing it from their dorm rooms, and the universities are sucking it up.
Yes, that's correct. So one of the most expensive things about mining is the electricity cost, because you're running computers 24/7. But fortunately for these students, the universities are the ones that are paying for the electricity. And it's actually not really clear whether or not these universities don't know or they don't care. The universities that I reached out to for my piece didn't comment on the story. But the students that I spoke to, all of them have been able to mine using the free electricity without any issue from their university thus far.
I would imagine they're not the first businesses to be run out of a dorm room, right?
That's correct. I mean, technically, Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook in his dorm room, so there's definitely parallels there.
Is there any way to know how many students are mining cryptocurrencies right now?
You really can't say, because, I mean, these universities don't typically monitor electricity use by room, and that's really the only way that you would be able to detect whether or not a student might be doing this kind of activity. So it's really hard to estimate how common it is.
Do students try to stay under the radar?
Yes, definitely. There was this one student I spoke to. His name is Mark. He's a junior at MIT. And he mentioned on his dorm there are about five of them who mine cryptocurrency in their dorm room.
That they know of.
That he knows of, yes. All of them try to make sure that they don't draw any more electricity than would actually trip the breaker. So they are very familiar with, you know, how much load they can draw before it actually could damage the system or cause the ire of facilities. So they're very careful about staying under the radar.
And is this a worldwide phenomenon?
Yes. So for my piece, I spoke with students from Singapore and Canada as well. And I suspect that it would definitely happen in other countries as well that I didn't find students from.
Is there a supposition that some of them are making some pretty serious money, or are they just playing?
Definitely for some of them, it has been extremely lucrative. For Mark, the MIT student, he told me that he estimates he's he's made around $20,000 in profit at this point. So that is certainly, he had a very methodical operation, and he takes a lot of care in making sure he's mining the right cryptocurrencies at the right times. So that was the most that I heard anyone had earned. But for most of the other students I spoke to, they actually were just mostly having fun and trying to learn more about the technology and didn't care as much about the profit.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how college students are mining cryptocurrencies. That means they're doing what? They're unlocking kind of these lock boxes of currency in, in the internet. It made me, you know, as usual, I talk about Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies about once a week, which means I go once a week back and do primers on it. I want to understand it better. And what I kind of finally sunk in this week for me was that whoever it is that created Bitcoin did it in a way that they created 21 million Bitcoins. Mm-hmm. All of it has to be mined. About 2/3 of it, maybe or more, is already been mined. And that the closer the miners get to the 21 million mark, the harder it gets.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. These students are coming in at it's pretty tough now.
Yes. So what's interesting, Bitcoin is one cryptocurrency, and it is the first cryptocurrency. That's why it's the most common. But since then, there have been many other alternate currencies. You can sort of think of them as spin-offs of Bitcoin. So they hold the same ideas and they use the same technology, but they might have different rules around how to actually mine the other currencies. And so for some of these students, they are mining Bitcoin, and they have to actually use very intensive, specialized hardware that's designed to output this much computational power.
Mm-hmm.
But for most of the students that I spoke to, they're actually mining these alternate cryptocurrencies that are not yet as popular as Bitcoin, and therefore they don't require hugely intensive operations. That's why they're able to do this with their desktop computers and with their laptops.
What do we know about the big cryptocurrency mining operations? What do they look like?
That's a great question. So one of my colleagues, Jun Wong, he reported on the huge Bitcoin mines in Inner Mongolia. And so as I mentioned previously, one of the biggest costs is electricity. And so the reason why these Bitcoin mines exist in Inner Mongolia is because it's very cheap electricity.
Okay.
And these are basically just giant warehouses that are filled with these Bitcoin mining machines, rows and rows and rows of them. And then there are these giant fans that cool down the machines. And then there's like a handful of people that will work around the clock to maintain these machines. And the moment one breaks down, they'll take it off the shelf, they'll fix it, put it back. It kind of looks like a data server. But it's actually, these are Bitcoin miners.
That was another element of your article, was the cooling of these machines in the dorm rooms. And it was kind of irritating to some of their, I would imagine, the people they live with.
Yes. So I think what these students don't pay for in terms of electricity, they definitely pay for in their personal comfort. These computers are extremely hot because they're running around the clock. And so these students came up with pretty innovative ways to release the heat from their rooms. Just to give an idea of how hot these machines can actually get, Mark, the MIT student, he was going through winter this season, and he actually had to turn off the heat in his room, and still the machines were actually melting any chocolate that he accidentally left in his dorm room. So they can really get quite hot. And there was this one student that I spoke to, Patrick Science. He is a student at Penn State University, or was a student at Penn State University, who recently graduated. He had a roommate when he first started mining. And for the sake of both of them, he bought these giant dryer tubes from Home Depot to connect to his computer so that they could funnel out of the window, the heat out of the window. And there were other students I spoke to who got the ire of their significant others for for running these machines overnight and making it really loud and hot to sleep with. So it was entertaining to hear their stories.
Yeah. And as you said, you did try to contact universities where this is happening. And do they even have any policies about this kind of thing?
That's a great question. So because these universities didn't respond to me for comment, I ended up getting in touch with a lawyer who is an expert in cyber law uh-huh. and technology. And he said that he actually thinks these universities haven't really thought about this issue yet. So they haven't developed a legal framework around whether or not this is an activity that they would allow on their campuses. And he thinks that they probably don't really have that big of an incentive right now to begin discussing this because this still doesn't seem to be a prevalent enough phenomenon for the universities to have their electricity bills go up a lot. But if this becomes a more popular phenomenon, he definitely thinks that universities will begin to feel the pressure to do something about it.
You wrote that a side effect of this student mining trend is that it is creating a new generation of cryptocurrency experts. Some of them just get into it for fun. Others get to know the system very, very well.
Yeah. So one thing that I was really struck by through my interviews is that these students really know the ins and outs of cryptocurrency and of blockchain, which is the technology that powers cryptocurrencies, more so than many of the average layperson or even the average technologist in Silicon Valley. And I was really impressed by how much experience they already had just from mining and doing their own investments in this kind of technology. And to me, I think that really goes to show that they're sort of ahead of the curve in learning about a technology that many people say will really impact how future technology is shaped. So I think that mining, in a way, has become this gateway for these students to learn more, be ahead of the curve, and possibly enter the industry much better prepared than the average technologist.
But they have very little protection. There have been hacks where huge amounts of currency have been stolen. What do they make of that, and are they worried?
Yeah, so the side effect of having very little to no regulation in cryptocurrency markets is that it is very susceptible to hacks. And so Mark, the MIT student that I spoke to, he was using this marketplace to buy and sell cryptocurrency, and that got hacked and he lost around $500. That isn't really too bad, considering that he made $20,000 in the process. But I did also speak with this other Stanford student, Raul, and he put $10,000 of his own money on this Bitcoin exchange, and that got hacked, and he lost every single penny. And so there's definitely risks to being part of this system. But what makes this system so compelling despite the risks is the fact that cryptocurrency is about decentralizing financial power into the hands of the people. And there are experts that I spoke to within this space that do believe that if this technology is applied correctly, it can really be pretty powerful in terms of financial inclusion. There are still 2 billion people in the world that don't have access to traditional financial services, don't have access to banks. And you could imagine that Bitcoin, which allows you to transfer money from one person to another without a bank, would actually be able to empower these people to finally be able to store and exchange money.
Karen Howell, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne.
That's Karen Howell. She's a tech reporter for Quartz. We'll post a link to her story about how college students are tapping into the mining of cryptocurrency. We'll have more Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The big consumer technology expo known as CES took place last week in Las Vegas. Tech companies from around the world showed up to reveal their latest and greatest products. We'll talk more about those later in the hour. But increasingly, auto companies are attending CES to show off cars that are basically becoming high-tech computers on wheels. Joining us now is Roadshow Reviews Editor for CNET, Emmy Hall. Welcome to the show, Emmy.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Autos are the CES now. I mean, everything pretty much revolves around autos, or at least it's the big thing. How long has that trend been moving in that direction?
You know, it's just been for the past couple years. You know, you've got your regular auto shows. We're here at the Detroit Auto Show right now, where automakers just show, like, this is our latest model year, and it's got this new thing and that new thing. But CES is really where automakers and suppliers show the inside, like the nitty-gritty technology of what is powering their new computer systems, what's powering their new AI, automated driving. All of those things are now all happening at CES, and it is slowly taking over the regular consumer electronics of it. It's really interesting to see. You know, it's always interesting to go to the Samsung booth and look at the big giant TV that they've got. That's always really cool. But, you know, this year Nissan did a thing where they read my brainwaves. Like, how is that happening at a car manufacturer booth? It's just insane.
It's not all fuddy-duddy anymore. I mean, there was a day when people wondered if the American car market was going to make it at all. And now they're cool people.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, Chevrolet is really on the forefront of autonomous driving. I mean, we can talk about Tesla, but, you know, Chevrolet has got, they were the first to market with an affordable EV that got over 200 miles, the Chevy Bolt. They are planning on having an autonomous vehicle, fully autonomous vehicle by 2019. With a partnership called Cruise, not to be confused with the Chevy Cruise, but a company called Cruise, and they are making an autonomous Bolt EV that I have seen driving around the streets of San Francisco with all the LiDAR, you know, spinning around, and people in the car with their computers marking down all the data that's coming through all those sensors. And they're planning on putting that into production by 2019. So Chevrolet really is on the forefront of that. Cadillac has been excellent. They have a self-driving, level 3 self-driving technology called Super Cruise that's incredible. It keeps you centered in the lane. It stops for you. It goes for you. It's a very accessible way to start with driving autonomously. I mean, yes, you still have to pay attention, but Cadillac has gone really far with the Super Cruise. So, yeah, and then Tesla is going really far with their pilot assist as well. And it's interesting to see how these American companies are really pushing the envelope when it comes to autonomy, whereas the European and Japanese companies, not so much.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about cars and tech. They pretty much took over this CES, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this year. It's been trending that way for a few years, but it's happened pretty fast. My guest is Emmy Hall. She's a Roadshow Reviews Editor for CNET. If you have a question or comment about what's out there and when it's coming, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What does the dashboards look like? How are the insides of the cars changing?
It's all about screens. There's screens everywhere. For autonomous vehicles, there's more of an emphasis on not only on comfort, but also on sociability between passengers. So the cabins are very open, very airy. There's, you know, a giant skylight across the roof. The whole roof is a glass panel. The chairs can move and swivel towards each other because in full autonomy, you don't need to be looking forward. So, you know, so you're not ignoring your rear seat passengers. And then everything, there's hardly any mechanical switch gear at all. A lot of the newer concept cars are showing screens across the entire dashboard with nary a button, nary a anything. There's no gear shift. There's nothing. It's really, you know, if you grew up with cars in the 70s and 80s like I did, you grew up with all of these very, very mechanical things. And then you look at all these screens, you're like, what is this brave new world I'm living in? It's absolutely fascinating.
Is there any pushback on that score? Because even though they're autonomous, they have to be able to be manually driven at some point, right?
Sure. And that's definitely where autonomy is going to go first, because you can't have people that are driving older manual cars along the same routes as an autonomous vehicle and not be able to have that human intervene in the autonomous vehicle. I mean, there's just too many parameters. There's too many things that can go wrong. And it's something really that the lawmakers are trying to deal with. How do you mix these two intrinsically very, very different types of vehicles on the same road? So I think first what will happen is cars will have autonomous functionality, but drivers will be able to take over whenever they want to. But, you know, in the future, 30 years down the road, who knows? It might be that we're all driving around little self-driving robots. And I do think that self-driving cars will first come into the ride-sharing market. I think that's where we're going to see it come in to common use at first.
Any news about whether there'll be some, like, a glove compartment for our jetpacks or anything?
I didn't see any jetpacks at CES, but that doesn't mean they weren't there. It is a giant show. But, you know, when you take out, especially when you take out an internal combustion engine, that leaves a lot more room. You know, the Tesla Model S has a trunk in the front and a little trunk in the rear because the batteries and the electric motor are so much, batteries are along the floor and the electric motor is so much smaller. So that's a lot of the reason why you can have more interior space, more cargo room in those electric vehicles. So it's possible, you know, we could have jetpacks, because storage car jetpacks.
How are voice assistants getting integrated into cars?
Oh, yeah. So Ford is now integrating Alexa into, like, all of their car. Well, not all of them, but the new Ford Ranger has it. And I believe the new Edge has Alexa integration. So, you know, you will be able to tell Alexa to turn on your lights, turn on your heater of your home, so that you can have that communication with your home while you're in the car. So there's no longer any of that, man, I really wish we could turn on this heat 20 minutes before we got home, or, man, I really wish we could have a pizza waiting for us when we got home. Now that you've got this this integration with Alexa and even with Google Home, you're able to kind of preload that stuff so that when you get there, your home and probably your pizza are right there waiting for you.
And you're just kind of talking to the car and telling it where to go and what you want to do?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you will enter your destination into the navigation system. So with the Amazon Alexa, and you're not actually telling the car, at least not to my knowledge, you're not telling the car, like, hey, Alexa, take me to the Las Vegas Convention Center. I think that is still programmed into the navigation system. But then while you're driving, you can say, hey, Alexa, turn off my lights in the bedroom, or, hey, Alexa, please be sure to record whatever it is, whatever TV show that you're working on. So anything that Amazon Alexa can do for your home, you can access those functionalities from the car.
Okay, well, let's get back to the brainwaves issue. How would a self-driving car use information from a passenger's brainwaves? What's going on with that?
All right, so let's say that that you're driving down the street, you're in the driver's seat, but your car's driving autonomously, and you're super late for your show, right? You have to get to the studio to get to the show, and the car in front of you brakes. So your car, because the safest thing for your car to do is to brake as well, is to slow down. But in your mind, there is a discord, because you're like, oh, I can't believe this car is braking. I really, really need to get to the studio. The brainwaves, this brainwave sensor thing, will understand that. It won't understand that you're late. It won't understand that you've got a radio show to do. It won't understand, you know, how you're feeling emotionally. It just understands that there's a discord between what the car is doing and what you want it to do. So then the car will say, all right, what's the next thing I could do? Oh, I could change lanes. So then it can change lanes and then continue on at its predetermined speed. So that's how they were pitching it to me for autonomous vehicles. Now, you would still have to wear this crazy little brain hat, but still, it gives you a better sense of comfort. You're more comfortable in the car because while you are not in control, it is still understanding where you feel comfortable with what the vehicle is doing.
Periodically, I have to insert a Black Mirror moment that there's something creepy going on here, and there's going to be a Black Mirror episode about it, you know, next season.
Yes, no, I completely agree. It is really, really creepy. And as someone who really enjoys driving manually, it's hard for me to give up that that level of control. Now, I have really gotten used to adaptive cruise control, which will follow a lead car. And when that lead car stops, your car stops when it goes. You know, that is fantastic for traffic jams. I live in San Francisco. There's traffic. It's terrible. That really takes a lot of stress off of my plate.
Mm-hmm.
So now that I've gotten used to that, like, okay, now the next step is I need to get used to a car changing lanes for me. So I think a lot of people will be able to adopt this kind of new technology, and it's going to be in stages. No one's going to get in a car and say like, okay, drive me to the mall and expect the thing to do it. Like, you just don't. And even every time I get into a new car with a new adaptive cruise control system, the first time I try it, trust me, my foot is covering that brake in case it decides to go all, you know, HAL 3000 on me. Like, yeah.
You wrote about a device designed to keep teen drivers safe. It's called Derive VQ. It's really about calming the nerves of the teen's parents, right?
Yeah, and thank God my mom didn't have it, or man, I wouldn't have had any fun. No, it's a really great way to help build good driving habits with newer drivers. You know, GM has had a technology called Team Driver in its cars that monitors the teen's actions. So it monitors like how many times the kid was wide open throttle, or how many times they had a braking incident, and then you can access that via a report card. This takes this one step further. It's a just a little dongle that fits into the OBD2 port, you know, the port that mechanics use to read the computer of your car. It just fits right in there, and you can set it up with an app on your phone for to limit speed. So you can limit the speed of the car to 55, 105, whatever you think is safe for your kid. It immediately turns off your phone. So it knows, the OBD dongle knows what phone is in the car, and it will turn it off except for emergency calls, so your teen can't access their phone. And it will not allow the car to start until you fasten your seatbelt. So it's a way to really build those good driving habits. Now, you can set the car to say, never go over the speed limit. But let's face it, if you're driving 55 on the highway, that might be the speed limit, but that's not really the speed limit. So parents can also set it to be 5 miles over the posted speed limit, 10 miles over the posted speed limit, to give a teen a little bit of leeway in case something happens, in case there is a predicament that they really need to accelerate around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right now it's available for fleets, but they had a really great reception at CES, and they're hoping to bring it to the consumer market pretty soon.
But ultimately, this all feels sort of short term, given the fact that we have autonomous cars on the horizon, and someday our kids going to even have to learn how to drive a car.
I hope that's not true.
I do too.
You know, I have always loved to drive, and I've always loved the feeling of freedom and independence that it gives me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all I need is a tank of gas, and I can go 600 miles on that tank of gas. You know, I can get out and find myself, and I can explore this world on my own terms. And that is something that I only can get from driving. I certainly, like, I don't get it from riding in a plane. And I don't get it from riding in an Uber. So it's something about that visceral connection that you have with the vehicle. I mean, self-driving cars have their place. Trust me, I hate commuting more than anybody else in the world, but I love to drive. Mm-hmm. And I hope that never goes away.
How long is your commute?
It's probably about an hour, but it's only 12 miles.
Oh, my gosh.
But I have to go. I know. I have to go over the Bay Bridge in San Francisco. So that toll plaza gets backed up a lot. And my daily driver is a manual. So it's 100 times worse.
Yeah. Wow. That's what I learned on. Okay. Have you already talked about the teen driver function from General Motors?
Yeah. So that was that is something that Derive had looked at and decided to bring that a bit further.
Gotcha.
Yeah, the teen driver is great. It's amazing. The fact that you can kind of spy on your kids, it gives me a little bit of glee. But again, like, really glad my parents didn't have it.
Exactly. And what about electric vehicles? What trends are we seeing there?
You know, range is getting bigger. The new Nissan Leaf gets 150 miles of range. Mm. I saw an electric motor that was stuffed into a new Corvette that one got 150 miles of range too, but that also produced massive amounts of torque. But we're seeing it's moved beyond the sub 100 miles of range, right? And I think people are getting out of the range anxiety. I know that when I get into an electric vehicle, I'm like, oh, where am I going to charge this? What's going to happen? How am I going to get this? Make sure that I have enough juice. I think the big problem with EVs is not only in the range, but it's also in the charging protocol, especially for folks like me and young people that live in a city. Because if you live in an apartment, it's real tough to charge your car. Like, I don't have a giant extension cord. And even if I did, if I'm charging it off of a regular household outlet, that's going to take forever. So until charging gets to the point where I can pull into a charging station and have it fully charged in 10 minutes, 15 minutes, it's going to be tough for a lot of people that don't have a garage or don't have a charger at work to be able to adapt to it.
Now, Columbus got one of those smart cities grants, and one of the aspects of that are public charging sites.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that's kind of where it has to go eventually, right?
Yeah, it does. And the part of the problem, too, is, like, I have checked on the app to see, like, hey, is the charger free? And only to go to the charger and have it be, like, a private charger for a corporation, and then I get kicked out of the parking lot. Don't ask me how that turned out. You know, or you go to a Whole Foods or someplace that has public charging stations, and there's a gas-powered car that's parked in the EV charging parking space.
Don't ask how that turned out either, yeah.
Yeah, no, I might have waited around and did a little bit of karate kick, self-righteous karate kick. But, yeah, there needs to be more opportunities to charge, and there needs to be quicker charging. And, I mean, it's happening. It is happening. It's just that it's going to take, like, we've had all our early adopters. Now if we want to get the regular Joe and Jane commuters onto the EV bandwagon, chargers have to be more plentiful, and they have to be quicker.
And then you said you were at the 2018 Detroit Auto Show. It's the biggest show in the nation, supposedly. It just kicked off. Is it kind of looking like CES out of Las Vegas?
No, not at all.
Interesting.
Not at all. I mean, there are some design concepts that are featuring, you know, full autonomy. But honestly, this show, they did three truck reveals. There's the new Ford Ranger is coming in 2019, like a new midsize pickup truck, which is a huge deal for Ford. They haven't had a midsize. The Ranger hasn't been around since like 2011. Ram redesigned its 1500 pickup truck. We saw the new Silverado. Now, they certainly talk about the tech that goes into those vehicles. Ram is using a mild hybrid system in their V8s, which is, it sounds a little weird, like, right, like a hybrid with a V8, but it's really a start-stop system and a regen braking, and it can give you a little boost of, like, instant torque from an electric motor, which is pretty cool, right? It's, like, a good way to get kind of the benefits of a hybrid without, like, the drawbacks of, I don't know, driving a Prius in the fast lane at 55 miles an hour. you know who you are, Prius drivers. So it's interesting, but the Detroit Auto Show is really more about the whole package, whereas CES is just about the technology that's inside.
Okay. Well, Emmy Hall, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm always down to talk about cars.
Emmy Hall is a Roadshow Reviews editor for CNET. More Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Each year, thousands of new gadgets are debuted at the big technology show in Las Vegas, CES. We just heard about some of the highlights coming from the automotive industry this year. Joining us now to talk about some of the other hits from CES 2018 is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Phones have been integrating fingerprint readers for a while now, but one company featured a new way to do it at CES. Is it Vivo or Vivo?
Vivo.
Okay. What are they doing?
Well, so this is something that's been rumored for a little while now, and it's something we're going to see starting with this this company this year, and it'll probably be a great deal more popular over into the next year. But the fingerprint sensors are actually being built directly into the display on this new phone, so that there's no separate kind of indentation on the phone, either on the front or the back or the side of the phone, that kind of takes up space. It's just under the display. So you put your thumb on the bottom of the display, and the sensor there reads your fingerprint.
How do they do that? I mean, this uses an optical sensor. What difference does it make?
Well, so there's two different ways to do this right now. There are two different companies that are working on two different implementations. And the big conversation right now is which is going to be the faster or more accurate. And both of those things are really important, because right now we have fingerprint sensors that take up a little bit of space on our phone, but they're really fast. And we also have had problems in the past where fingerprint sensors weren't, you know, as accurate as they probably could have or should be. Because we use these things to protect quite a bit of information.
Mm-hmm.
So the two big things here, you know, the two different implementations involve how the kind of picture of your finger is being taken and stored and used to, you know, verify that it's you. And this method is a little different. It uses this optical sensor. It's almost like a camera that's taking a picture of your thumb each time you put it on the sensor.
Versus the touch.
Right. The touch sensor is really just kind of it's taking a picture in a different way. Instead of using an optical sensor, it's using almost like vibrations to you know, feel the ridges in your finger and have that picture taken a different way.
Do we know when this is going to be out and part of a phone we can buy?
This is going to be out later this year in a phone released internationally, but the Vivo phone is probably not coming to the United States at all. That will likely have a different manufacturer, you know, having a phone with a fingerprint sensor built into the display later this year that comes to the U.S. But it likely won't be Vivo, because they're not particularly well known here in the States.
Is this fingerprint reading technology going to be around, do you think? Does it have staying power?
This is definitely going to continue being a thing. There's been a ton of research that suggests that, you know, while the whole face unlocking thing is really cool and something that's been made popular, especially recently by the iPhone, having a fingerprint sensor is still a more secure method for just about every implementation of security. And so that's going to be something that a lot of particularly work-based solutions depend on. You know, companies and corporate infrastructures and things are going to want the fingerprint option over the face unlock option for a lot of things. So this is something we're going to keep seeing fingerprint sensors continue to be a big deal, especially over the next couple of years. If it's you know, easier to put in the phone without taking up a whole lot of space, that it's something that we'll continue to see grow and change.
But it's got to be taking up space inside, right?
It is. It's taking up space, a little bit more space under the display, instead of having to take up space beside the display or on top of the display or anything like that. And so the phone can't get too much thinner, in effect, but it can become narrower or the edges can become, you know, less flat to force room for those surfaces.
We have talked about Moto Z phones before. These phones from Motorola have a selection of accessories that can attach to the back of the phone. And at CES, a new health monitor was unveiled. What more can they know about us when it comes to our health?
A ton. You know, the Lenovo, it's called the Lenovo Vital Mod. And it is an entire health kit that you strap onto the back of your phone instead of doing something like wear a wrist cuff. You would, you know, take this and occasionally use it on your phone. And instead of having this thing on your wrist or this thing on your arm that measures, you know, your pulse and stress level and things like that, it actually just requires that you put your finger inside of this socket on the back of the phone.
Okay. And a socket on the back of the phone, like first you put the socket on the phone, do you carry it around with you, or is it always attached to it, or what?
You can leave it attached. It's a little big, so I doubt that most people will, but it is an option. This is just something that you would use in exchange of, you know, kind of the larger arm cuff design. You know, you would pull this out probably at a desk or at home, anywhere that you would be regularly measuring things like heart rate or your respiratory rate or blood pressure or things like that, you would probably keep this in that general area and then pull it out when you needed it.
What's the appeal of it? I mean, is there a wide appeal, or are they targeting some audience?
Yeah, so medical tech is always, you know, kind of a fascinating thing, because the idea here is that this information can be very easily recorded and then sent immediately to your doctor. Mm. So instead of having something that, you know, the user is required to document, you know, kind of individual activities and then have it all written down and then hand to the doctor, something like this can be built into a special medical app that just immediately emails that information to your doctor as soon as the information is recorded. And that way, if there are any you know, disturbing trends in your health or anything like that, the doctor has that information right away.
I also can see it being used against us when we want to call in sick and they're like, yeah, you're not sick. You don't have a temperature and your heart rate's fine.
There, I mean, that's some Black Mirror stuff you've got going on.
I'm always talking Black Mirror. That's what I do. Think about it. I, of course, never call it sick. Unless I really am, but... Are you there, Russ?
It'd be really cool to see, you know, the different ways that this could be used aside from reporting directly to your doctor. I'm not fond of the idea of my boss saying, hey, you know, give me a health checkup real quick.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not impossible.
Oh, boy. Is there any reason this couldn't work with other phones? Does it have to be a Moto Z, or is it just an attachment that can be used with any phone?
No, this is built specifically for Motorola phones that have the Moto Mod system built into the back. Now, the company that worked with Lenovo to make these can and likely will make a standalone kind of Bluetooth version. That we've seen that a lot with different companies. But this one here is really built for that kind of convenience of being able to just clip it right onto the back of the phone and not have to worry about having a separate battery or anything like that.
Okay. Another product you wanted to talk about can turn a smartphone into a laptop. Is that just a keyboard? It's called Project Linda.
So Project Linda is a special thing from Razer, and it's designed to work specifically with the Razer phone that they made earlier this year. Razer is a big gaming company. They make a lot of gaming keyboards and mice and laptops that are very focused on you know, delivering a gaming experience. And they did the same thing with this phone, but they offered this kind of concept laptop where you put the phone inside of the laptop body, right where the trackpad on your laptop would be. And the computer, you know, was basically an empty shell that now uses that phone as a processor and as storage. So it becomes this full laptop where you have access to all of your apps on the screen. And the phone then actually becomes the trackpad for this computer, where you move your finger along the screen and it actually moves the mouse on the display on the laptop.
Oh, okay. I get it. And why? Why this?
You know, we've seen this, you know, across this last year. There's been a lot of push for, you know, kind of the having this single computer where you have, you know, Samsung did this with what they call the Dex Dock, where you took your phone and you docked it into this thing and connect it to a television, and it gives you this kind of experience that looks like a desktop computer, but it runs all of the apps and everything that you would normally have on your phone. And we've seen several examples of this over the year, and this push from all of these different companies is to give you know, business travelers and a single device, basically, you know, where all of their information is stored on their phone, but they can access it from these different places.
What are some of the hurdles to getting something like this to work really well? I mean, does it already work? Do they know?
They had, you know, demonstration models that were out that we tested in several places, and they worked really well. You know, they run all of the apps that are on your phone without any serious problems. The biggest thing here is going to be cost. You know, Razer hasn't said anything about what these would cost if they decide to make them and sell them. This was a, you know, kind of a prototype experiment thing, which Razer loves to do during CES. Mm-hmm. You know, to make something like this would be expensive and would probably cost at least as much as the phone did, if not a little more. Mm-hmm. So it would be one of those things where, you know, if Razer sold enough of these phones, then, you know, there would potentially be an audience that would justify, you know, making these accessories to buy. But if they don't end up selling enough of these phones, then, you know, making these isn't going to be worth it to them.
How did they look? I mean, did it look good? Was the quality good?
It looks fantastic. It looks like a laptop. You know, this is something that we've seen other companies, Motorola, for example, tried to do in the past, and they just didn't look great. It had kind of the phone almost dangling off the back, and this really looked like, a complete thought. It looked like a laptop that you could close and you know, walk around and not have to worry about, messing up the phone in any way. And the software that was on it seemed to work really well.
What do you think they need to change about it to make it go into production? Is it just about demand, or is it about
something
else?
I think
ultimately
it comes down to demand. You know, okay. This is not like, this isn't the Razr phone is not a tremendously popular phone. They don't sell like iPhones or like Samsung phones. So it's hard to say right now how many people even own the phone, in order to say, yes, it's worth it to have these things, made to sell to probably only, 2% of the people who own them to begin with. But really this idea is something that we've seen grow over the last year, where there is apparently a group of people who really want that their phone to be their only computer in certain situations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have talked about smart lighting systems for the home before, and there's some news from Philips. What?
Philips announced a ton of stuff during CES. This new thing that they're calling the Entertainment Center. The Entertainment Center basically allows your Philips Hue lights to cooperate with your certain computers and certain computer technology, and in the future integrate with things that are playing on your television, so that you kind of get this whole room feel when you're watching a movie. The lights in the room will actually change colors to match the things that are happening in the movie, which is a really cool idea and something that we've seen them experiment with before, particularly with the Sci-Fi Channel. But this is going to, kind of grow over the next year to become this kind of full entertainment solution. But they were they had this kind of one caveat to this in that the bridge that most people own that connects all of the smart lights that you might own to your network is out of date. It doesn't offer the security solutions that are necessary to work with Apple's HomeKit solution. And so this is the first thing that Philips has released, this the first kind of software feature that they've released that isn't available to every Philips Hue owner. They are requesting that people upgrade to this new what they call the bridge that connects the network to all of these lights.
Okay, so how much is that going to cost?
They are $60 right now, and you can find them in just about every electronic store. Best Buy has them and Walmart has them and a bunch of other places. And it's pretty simple to replace them, without messing up any of the things that you already have going on with your lights. But if you have the original design that came with your Hue lights, if you bought them, say, a year ago or something like that, then you're going to want to upgrade to this new bridge.
And again, the Hue lights are things that you put in everything from your lamp to the light, to the ceiling lamp or whatever.
Yeah, they make Hue bulbs for just about every kind of light socket now. You can have tons of different lights that all kind of work together. They can, operate on specific schedules, so you don't have to think about them. They can change the white color temperature throughout the day so that they are they have less blue, in the evening when you are closer to going to bed, and more blue in the morning when you want to wake up. There's a lot of options there.
It's crazy, Tom. Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us and giving us this update on CES.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He is contributing editor at Android Central. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.